mid-June 1889. The Judith River runs cold through central Montana Territory. The water flows down from the Little Belt Mountains, snaking through grassland where cattle ranches have only just begun to replace the buffalo herds. A rancher riding his property spots something caught against the rocks near Sample's Crossing. At first, he thinks it's driftwood. Then he gets closer. A body, a woman face down, well-dressed, too well-dressed for drowning. Before the week ends, four more will surface. Five people scattered across miles of river. Two married couples and a six-year-old girl. They'd left Helena with dreams. A new wagon built by one of the finest manufacturers in the country. Two heavy draft horses worth a small fortune. Fine clothes. Jewelry glinting in the Montana sun. They traveled more than 100 miles from the territorial capital. They'd been looking for opportunity, for a place to settle, for the promise the West kept making to those brave enough to chase it. They'd hired a guide. His name was James Wilbur, and within 2 weeks of those bodies surfacing, he'd be dead, too, hanging from his jail cell in Great Falls by a method so elaborate that newspapers called it the work of a fiend incarnate. And within a month after that, someone would dig up his body from Potter's Field. It would vanish forever. Welcome back, friend, to Hometown History, the podcast that takes a stroll down the main streets and back alleys of the past to uncover how local stories shaped the world. I'm Shane Waters. And today we're exploring Lewistown, Montana, where in 1889, five immigrants hired a guide to lead them to a gold camp, and that guide murdered every single one of them. June 1889. Montana Territory had precisely 5 months left before achieving statehood, and the Judith Basin remained frontier in the truest sense. A contemporary newspaper put it quite plainly. Fewer than 10 fixed homes stood between the Ubet Stage Station and Billings, the distance of nearly 100 miles. Long stretches of grassland where a traveler might not see another human being for days. The gold camp at Maiden had proven remarkably prosperous. Miners had extracted over $3 million from its hills. A fortune that drew prospectors from across the country and beyond. The camp had swelled to 1,200 souls, complete with saloons and the rough-hewn infrastructure of a boomtown. Edward Biggs and his wife Lucina had spent the past year in Helena, the territorial capital. Same with Joseph Kurtz and his wife Sarah. The men had worked mining claims there before, earned their stake, saved their money. Now they sought, as one newspaper carefully recorded, a desirable place to settle and make a home. Little Ida Shosh traveled with them, 6 years old. Her exact relationship to the two families, the historical record simply doesn't explain. Was she a niece, a daughter of friends, an orphan taken in? The newspapers of 1889 didn't think to ask, and now we'll never know. But this much was clear. The party looked prosperous. It acquired a new Bain wagon, a respected brand, built sturdy for the frontier. Two state horses, each weighing around 1,300 pounds, new harness with ivory rings, a buckskin pony. Gear that announced to anyone watching, these folks had means. And quite visible personal wealth. Frontier John Beck would later testify that the party appeared unusually well-dressed for immigrants, with considerable jewelry on their persons. That visible prosperity painted a target on their backs. Enter James Wilbur, about 32 years old. The newspapers would later call him a wily criminal from Great Falls. Though what crimes preceded murder, if any, the record doesn't preserve. He offered his services as a guide to the Maiden Gold Camp. Common practice in territory where trails went unmarked and water sources meant the difference between survival and death. They trusted him. June 6th, the party passed through the Ubit stage station. Heading northeast, towards Maiden Gold Camp, the station keeper noted their arrival. Nothing unusual. Just another group of immigrants, chasing the same dreams that had drawn so many others. The next day, June 7th, around 1 in the afternoon, Frontier John Beck encountered them on the road between Beaver Creek and Rock Creek. He pulled his team aside to let them pass. Beck would remember it quite vividly in the weeks to come. Their appearance, their wagon, their jewelry catching the afternoon light. The woman he spoke with told him they were looking for a desirable place to settle. They seemed hopeful. That night, on a bench of land between Spring Creek and Cottonwood Creek, James Wilbur murdered all 5 of them. No witnesses survived to testify. But investigators would later piece together what happened from physical evidence and Wilbur's own behavior. He used a rifle. He disposed of the bodies in the Judith River at scattered locations, miles apart, so discovery would be delayed. He burnt the party's trunk in the campfire, leaving only the iron fittings in the ashes. Then he loaded the wagon and headed northwest. June 8th, sunrise. Rancher L.S. Butler was out looking for stray horses when he spotted a man in a wagon on that same benchland. Butler rode within 20 feet of the stranger, asked about the horses, asked where he was headed. The man gave nothing, barely spoke at all. But Butler noticed something quite strange. The wagon appeared full to the top of the box, packed tight with goods, the canvas sheet tucked carefully around all sides. On his way home, Butler found a smoldering campfire, and in the ashes, what looked like trunk irons. He didn't realize it yet, but he'd just spoken with a murderer. June 9th, noon. Frontier J.W. Morgan stopped to camp at Loose Creek, and a stranger joined him for lunch. The man said only that he was from Nebraska, but Morgan found him very reticent. The stranger refused to eat, refused to drink, acted very queer, Morgan would later testify. Something was quite wrong with this man. Then Saturday, June 15th, the first body surfaced at Staples Crossing, a woman face down in the Judith River. The community realized what they had on their hands. Sheriff Clary of Fergus County began tracking the killer through suspicious trades. At James Woods Ranch, a man calling himself Jack Gilding had traded fine horses for ordinary mares. At Kastner's place on Belt Creek, the same man traded a distinctive Bain wagon for a battered spring wagon. At Howard Crisis's blacksmith shop in Great Falls, that spring wagon had been repaired. The trail pointed northwest towards Sand Coulee. Telegraph wires hummed between jurisdictions. Messages between Lewistown, Great Falls, and every settlement in between.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my site softer?
Can I make my site firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side, your Sleep Number setting. Enjoy personalized comfort for better sleep night after night. And now, during our President's Day sale, take 50% off our limited edition bed, plus free home delivery with any bed and base. Ends Monday. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Coordination between Fergus County, Cascade County, and Great Falls demonstrated sophisticated police work for the territory. But first, they had to catch him. June 21st, early morning. The sky just beginning to lighten over the Montana plains. Near Cascade, Sheriff Downing and Deputy Joe Hamilton spotted a wagon through their field glass. A man had made camp half a mile off the main road. The kind of detour someone makes when they don't want to be seen. The two lawmen approached with guns drawn. When they got close enough, they shouted for the man to raise his hands. Wilbur's right hand drifted toward his hip pocket, toward the self-cocker revolver he kept there. His wife, roused from sleep in the wagon, began screaming, "Don't kill my husband, you villains!" and what witnesses described as other incoherent exclamations. Downing and Hamilton held steady. They secured a Winchester rifle from the wagon. They disarmed Wilbur, and they ordered him to hitch up his team and accompany them to Great Falls. He arrived at the county jail around noon. James Wilbur would not see another sunrise. Around midnight Friday, less than 12 hours after his arrest, prisoners in the Great Falls jail heard a noise. Something heavy, dropping. They assumed someone had fallen from a bunk. Just another drunk losing his balance. No one called for the jailer. At 7 o'clock the next morning, the jailer made his rounds. He found James Wilbur hanging from the top of his cell, cold, stiff, dead. The method was quite elaborate. So elaborate that it shocked every hardened frontiersman. He'd torn a strip from his blanket, tied it as a loop near the top of the cell bars, torn another strip from his pillow slip to form a noose, used his silk handkerchief to bind his right wrist to his right ankle, made another slip knot connecting his left wrist to his left ankle, with both feet drawn up so they couldn't possibly touch the floor. He rolled himself off his bunk and into the noose. The Great Falls leader captured the territory's stunned reaction. No one but a fiend incarnate could have conceived and carried out such a means for self-destruction. No confession, no explanation, no final words. The five people he'd murdered on that benchland, they would never know why they died. Their families would never witness a trial, never hear a verdict. Officials interviewed other prisoners to verify this was suicide and not a nighttime lynching. Folks quite understood that vigilante justice remained a genuine possibility. But no, Wilbur had done this himself. He'd escaped whatever justice awaited him. Or so everyone thought. Undertaker Powers buried James Wilbur in a potter's field at Highland Cemetery in Great Falls. Plain pine coffin, unmarked grave. The lot reserved for the unclaimed, the indigent, and the damned. Nobody came forward to claim his body. His wife, present at the arrest, screaming for his life, vanished from the historical record. Weeks later, a groundskeeper noticed disturbed earth in Potter's Field. Someone had been digging recently. They raised the coffin, empty. The Great Falls Tribune reported it with what reads, "Across a century," like a shrug. Where it has gone to, no one in authority seems to know or care. Folks had theories, of course. Folks always have theories. One held that someone roused to indignation, as the papers put it, couldn't stomach a murderer resting in the same cemetery as decent people. So they dug him up and disposed of him elsewhere. Another theory whispered that doctors had taken him. The 1880s remained the final years, when medical schools sometimes relied on grave robbing. The medical profession had actually been offered Wilbur's body before burial, but they declined, deeming it perhaps unlucky to make use of it, even for surgical purposes. So said the newspapers. But perhaps someone changed their mind. A third theory, never officially endorsed but persisted in local memory, held that Wilbur's body ended up displayed in some doctor's office in Great Falls. A curiosity, a specimen, a reminder of what evil looks like when it wears a man's face. The Tribune's conclusion? It looks as if public execration pursued the murder to the grave. James Wilbur had escaped earthly justice through suicide, but someone made sure he didn't rest in peace. His body was never recovered. The victims, Edward and Lucina Biggs, Joseph and Sarah Kurtz, and 6-year-old Ida Schoss, were pulled from the Judith River over several terrible days. Where they were ultimately buried, the historical record does not preserve. 5 months after those murders, November 8, 1889, Montana achieved statehood. The formal structures of American law replaced territorial justice. The last frontier officially closed. What does Lewistown, Montana remember about James Wilbur? By all accounts, not much. The Judith Basin moved on. Gold gave way to cattle ranching. Cattle ranching gave way to wheat farming. The stage road became a highway. Maiden, the gold camp those five travelers never reached, became a ghost town, its buildings rotting back into the hills that once made it rich. But the case illuminates something essential about the movement when frontier became state. Look at what happened in those few weeks of June 1889. Sheriff Clary coordinated a manhunt across county lines using telegraph technology. Witness testimony was gathered systematically. Physical evidence was tracked through a chain of transactions. This was modern police work, recognizable today. And yet, someone still dug up a grave in the night and made a murderer's body vanish. That older impulse, the one that operates outside courtrooms and official records, the one that says some crimes deserve punishment beyond what the law provides, it persisted right alongside the telegraphs and the coordinated investigations. The victims themselves, the Biggs family, the Kurtzes, little Ida Schoss, they'd done nothing wrong. They'd simply trusted a guide. In territory where trails were unmarked and water sources meant survival, hiring someone who claimed to know the way was the reasonable choice. They had no way of knowing, no way of distinguishing a legitimate guide from a predator wearing a helpful face. And that's the part that haunts, isn't it? The randomness of it. The way safety and danger can look exactly the same until it's too late. That's the story of five travelers who trusted the wrong man in a territory poised between two ideas of justice. If you found this story as haunting as I did, share it with someone who loves forgotten American mysteries. I'm Shane Waters. Every hometown has a story. Tonight, it's the benchland between Spring Creek and Cottonwood Creek, where five hopeful travelers trusted the wrong guide. Good night, friend.